Thanks, Will, and thanks for the kind invitation and hospitality. So I'll talk a bit about what we can learn about most exotic states of matter. I have this new fancy pointer, so let's try that out. In principle, the talk will be structured in four sections. First, I'm not sure how familiar we all are with neutron star mergers, so I say a few words on that. I will then go on and talk a bit about what we can learn about radius constraints from the latest detection of gravitational waves. It was 2 years ago. Before going into the main topic, and this is what we can learn about this exotic phase transition at super high densities from future observations of neutron star mergers. And then a bit different from what was announced, I will also show some recent results I have on electromagnetic precursors from neutron star mergers, since there was some interest here in learning about those. So let's just get started. And just in a nutshell, like when we want to talk about neutron star mergers, maybe we should talk about what neutron stars are. And I think it's good to kind of make sure we all know where they come from. And this is like one potential source. That's the Crab Nebula. That's the supernova remnant. And so neutron stars are generally formed by supernova explosions when the massive iron core of the star collapses and forms a proto-neutron star. Now that we know where they come from, how do we know they exist? Well, the thing is that neutron stars have strong magnetic fields, some 10 to the 8, even magnetar strength 10 to the 15 Gauss, and this allows us by radio emission to actually see them. And so at the center of this Crab Nebula, there will be such an object that is radiating and that we can detect. Now that we know where they come from, kind of we know how they emit, how we can see them, like what do we otherwise do we know about them? And here we know that they have roughly the mass of the sun. So you take all of the sun and you compress that to the size of your favorite city. Like, this is mine. If you're not familiar with this, maybe take Manhattan. That roughly has a similar size of like 12 to 14 kilometers. I'm not sure how large Toronto is, but might also fit if you just paste that in there. And so really the neutron star has like the mass of the sun compressed to like a very tiny space. So you have really the curvature that otherwise you only find in black holes. And now, why are they interesting for studying the phase transition is really that because they contain so much matter in such a tiny space, they reach extreme densities beyond nuclear saturation. And at those densities, we can excite all kinds of funny states. Like you can get your kaons, your pions. Maybe you even get a transition to a quark-gluon plasma. And so you can think of them like a cosmic laboratory where just right at the center, we have our region of interest. And we need to probe this using several tools. And one of them will be gravity. So now that we know where they come from, maybe we just go right at the end and think about what do they end up in? Like, what is the final state? What is the fate of like the neutron star? And there we realize that most of them don't live alone. They have a companion, so they will typically live in this binary. And this will emit gravitational waves. This is something we have seen, and this kind of makes it interesting because this is how like we know about them gravity-wise, okay? Because the gravitational wave emitted from the system can be detected by detectors like LIGO. Now, the fate will essentially be determined by what mass each of these stars will have. So say you have very high mass stars, then the fate is pretty clear, like you merge them together. And as I will tell you later in this talk, the remnant you will form will be so massive you cannot support the gravitational pull. And that means that the neutron star will immediately collapse to a black hole with a very low mass torus and essentially like this is gone. So the system is not particularly interesting other than actually setting constraints on part of the equation of state. The other system that you can have if you go to the other end, if you say, okay, I merge two stars that have very low masses, say each of them has 1.2, then you will end up with a remnant that is unconditionally stable even on long timescales. And so ultimately this can be like a potential source of magnetars because in the merger itself, we will produce super strong magnetic fields. And so really this ends up in like just like a stable, uniformly rotating star with very strong fields ultimately. Now, the most interesting case for what we do, kind of the vanilla case, and one that we believe to have observed, is when you're somewhere in the blurry lines in between this case and this case. So this is where you do form a remnant, but the remnant will not live for very long. You will collapse to a black hole, and this contains some very interesting physics. But Now that the system is highly dynamical, it contains, as you can see in this visualization, all kinds of shocks, there's dynamic gravity going on. You need to model this on the computer. Like, you cannot treat this analytically. And if you model something on the computer, you need to put different physics in. You need to tell the computer, like, what equations to solve, what physics you want to model. And there are various components that we need in order to understand the system. Like, of course, the most obvious one is we need some form of gravity, simply to account for having the inspiral of the two stars, having the merger, having black hole formation. So we need to solve the equations of numerical relativity. In addition, because we're not treating black holes, we're really treating like solid objects, we need a way to describe matter. And for this, we need to also include hydrodynamics. Okay, so these are like the most two basic ingredients. But then, because, I mean, this is not water, right? We need to tell our hydrodynamics what the star actually looks like. And so we need some additional input from physics that tells us, okay, this is actually nuclear matter. And for that, you need something called an equation of state. So you need some prescription that says, okay, the pressure is a function of my density, my temperature, because you can reach very high temperatures here just right at the contact layer when they touch, and maybe nuclear composition if you want to have like a more fancy model. And so already with these three, would be sufficient if you're interested in doing gravitational waveform models, want to constrain the equation of state, and want to basically understand what we can currently detect with gravitational wave detectors. But we want to be a bit more bold. We want to have additional physics. We also want to understand, is there any electromagnetic counterpart? What's the long-term evolution? And their magnetic fields will be very important. And so in addition, we should maybe supplement all of this with the Maxwell equations. However, we're still not done yet, because the thing is, since you have very high temperatures, you will also have changes in composition. You can have weak interactions, and so you need some sense of neutrinos, right? Some sense of radiation transport. And so in principle, if we want to model like a state-of-the-art system like this, you need various components, like all of them that I list here, that you need to include in your simulation in one form or another. Like, I can already tell you this is the most complicated one. It's the most complicated equation, and we can't fully incorporate that already. Now, if you can do this, what does that look like? So you take all of this, you put this on a supercomputer, you take two stars, you take one equation of state. It's actually an old one. This one is ruled out, so don't look at the details too much, okay? But this is like the vanilla case, 2.7 solar masses in total. You put them on the computer, you start the simulation, and what you see is you see that the two stars will begin to orbit each other. While they do this, they emit gravitational waves, so they lose angular momentum and they come ever closer. And at some point, once you have radiated away enough angular momentum, they will finally start to touch and merge. And exactly at that point, you will see there will be a shock coming out of the system, just like here. This is part of your dynamical mass ejection. There's also mass ejection going on longer timescales. And now you form this hypermassive neutron star, and because you basically have like a rotating bar, it emits more and more gravitational radiation, it removes angular momentum, and then this hypermassive neutron star will be unstable to gravitational collapse. So this really is kind of the vanilla case. If we had a bit more physics in like magnetic fields, it would even get more interesting if we were to run this for longer. But just for the purpose of illustration, I think this already shows like what the system should roughly look like.
Does that simulation include nuclear binding energy?
In the equation of state, yes. So all the microphysics in that sense is only included in the equation of state. We have no like kinetic modeling of these effects. It's really just like...
You should expect incredible gamma ray emission and all sorts of things, right?
Like, yes, but that is on larger scales. I mean, here we're really just on the millisecond scale right after merger. I mean, all of the densities there are so high, you will not have any radiation that will escape the system. So that's not important at the moment. This will really happen if you know, you run this for longer, you get some funnel clearing, you get some jet launching, but even then your emission will happen on much larger time length scales than the merger site. And just to summarize a bit of the nice physics we can do with the system, I have like three slides that look at the various kind of phases of the merger. Like the first one is the interesting one, because this we have observed and we continue to observe that with more observations, is if we look at the gravitational waves that have been emitted. And in principle, you can just split up the waveform, this is what that looks like, in two phases, one coming from the inspiral and one being the post-merger. This one has very high frequency, as you can just see by eye if you compare like the oscillations here with the oscillations there. So this is something that we currently cannot detect, but the nice thing that we can detect, and we have detected, is just part of this inspiral. And this inspiral is already enough because it will contain an imprint of the nuclear matter inside the neutron stars that orbit each other, and this will give us later on some constraints on the equation of state. And then at the end of the talk, I will tell how in the future we could use this to learn something on like the fundamental interaction of QCD. Another thing, just going to these gamma rays and optical afterglows that I will not touch upon in this talk, is that basically after a long time scale, when you have this black hole and the torus, you can maybe get a jet out. We haven't simulated that yet, but at least we have some strong belief, since we have a coincident gamma ray burst detection, that that happens. And so this really makes a connection and allows us, like, on a different window to access the system beyond gravitational waves only. So this really gives like a rich phenomenology from this late evolution of the system. And finally, all that mass that was being emitted and that we saw in the movie, and a lot more mass that will come from this torus that is mainly magnetically and neutrino driven on longer time scales, will produce a very rich afterglow phenomenology, can produce the heaviest elements in the universe, can produce a lot of gold, and this is also what we have observed in the merger event. So this is kind of a third very interesting channel that we have to the system. So now that we have some idea of, you know, how the neutron star merger works, what in principle we can learn from it, what parts of the merger to look at, I want to briefly describe what we have done in the aftermath of GW170817 to use the detection of the gravitational waveform from the in-spiral to constrain the radius and maximum mass of neutron stars. And so here, the idea is essentially the following. I mean, we had this coincident detection that you maybe have seen many times, so I will just skip this slide. But we believe for some reason that I will tell in a minute that in principle this was of the vanilla type case that I was showing in the movie. So first that you had this in spiral, you had the hypermassive neutron star phase, and ultimately the black hole torus phase. And assuming this case, we can learn a lot from the system in terms of maximum mass and radius. And so this is the part that we have detected. This we have actually not detected in gravitational waves, okay? This we only know by indirect measurements from looking at the optical afterglow. And just to summarize a little bit on, you know, how just from this little part of the waveform we can learn something on the properties of the neutron star, we have to think how this system with the neutron stars is different from a black hole, because we have also observed black holes, they had no matter, so they couldn't tell us something. And the reason really is that the neutron stars are extended objects, they're not point particles, they really have like an extent, and that means that they can be tidally deformed by their companions. So what does that mean? If you just, you know, go to the seaside and you do vacation, you will notice that at the sea you will have low and high tides. And these will basically come from an interaction of the Earth with the moon. So the moon is going around and then the Earth is slightly tidally deformed, it's slightly squeezed, and this causes high tides and low tides. And in the neutron star, the very same thing is happening. While it's orbiting with its companion, the companion will deform the star, and then the squeezing of the star that you see here in the Earth would be encoded in the waveform. And so by looking at the waveform would tell us something, how much can I squeeze a neutron star? And the squeezing will depend on material properties. So this tells us something on what my matter is allowed to do. Okay, this is the full logic behind this. If you want to see an equation, this is basically what this looks like. There's this one number, it's called the tidal deformability. This we can get from the waveform at high PN order. In principle, this thing is proportional to the radius to the fifth power, so it means if I say later on this number is high, this means my star is big. If this number is small, the star is small. Okay, so we basically get roughly a direct measurement on how big the star is, and since this is a purely determined by the matter of inside the star, so by the composition, we can try to invert this relation and see, okay, given some measurement of this number, what is the allowed radius? What is my allowed equation of state going to do? Now, how we do this is we look at our LIGO detection paper and we look at what the gravitation wave detection has provided us with, and then we see this not only told us like the total mass and something about the mass ratio, but really the waveform had an upper limit on this number. And so in principle, this gravitation wave detection told us, okay, given this detection, the stars could not have been too large. In principle, you can translate that number, and this will tell you, okay, my star in the binary could not have been larger than about 13.2 kilometers. Okay, this just comes from the gravitation wave observation alone. That's already something, because before we had like stellar models for neutron stars that were like 14, 15 kilometers. The other information now comes when looking at this optical afterglow, because the afterglow comes from the decay of heavy elements, And because you can basically look at what those light curves look like, you can infer back how much mass must my system have ejected in order to produce these light curve emissions. And you can see that we had different channels. We had about almost 0.1 solar mass that was ejected roughly, depends a bit on the model that you use. And then you can ask yourself, okay, given numerical simulations that we have, is there a particular correlation between the size of the star and the amount of matter that the system has ejected? And so is there like a lower limit on my neutron star size? And what has been found is the following. This is just one of the works. There are also other works. The idea is if you plot now as a function of this lambda, so basically as a function of the radius of the star, the amount of matter that could at most have been ejected in such a simulation, you find that there's a clear correlation that says, okay, if I want to be consistent with my detection, my stars must have had a finite size. So everything up here that is above this line is roughly consistent. And so this gives us a lower limit. In this study, it says, okay, this lambda number is larger than 400. More recent studies basically show if you account more properly for unequal mass effects and systematic uncertainties, this could be as low as 200. But in principle, this tells us that just from the observation of the optical afterglow, you get my star cannot be too small, and from the observation of the gravitational waveform, you get my star cannot be too large. So you have a bracket in which the stellar radius can lie, and now I will show you how we translate this to constraints on the equation of state. Okay, just by combining the information from the gravitational wave and the optical afterglow emission. Okay, that's the logic we're going to follow. Yes, that comes now.
Are assuming something about the spin distribution?
So here we're not assuming something on the spin distribution, but in principle, if you look at the gravitational wave observation, like the spin is rather on the lowish side, at least they cannot really constrain it from the waveform, but I think they claim an upper limit of 0.1 or so in dimensionless spin on the single neutron star. Roughly.
Okay, it's the question. Maybe the question is that do you assume a prior line? Which is, like I said, there's a conservative prior and then there's a...
Ah, yes. So we use for most of this analysis the conservative low spin prior. Yes. Okay. There's also the high spin prior. This is true. But that shifts the distribution only lightly. So there's not much that's going to change there. Yeah. Well, because most of the cutoff that we get is actually from the afterglow. It's not so much from the upper limit.
Right, there's this very strong conclusion at the end that you're saying that you could get a lower bound on the radius, and that's strongly dependent on some of these assumptions.
Yes, the lower bound, like the exact number of the lower bound, is very strongly dependent.
Or where you have one to begin with.
Yes. So we have basically in this study, because it was one of the early studies, we have used a very high bound. So we cut off a lot of, like I will show this, we cut off a lot of the allowed radius range. In principle, you would have to be more conservative and allow for a lower limit. But that doesn't change like the general logic of the argument of how this works. Also, it will not change. I mean, there have been like maybe 50 studies or so in the meantime. And it doesn't change too much, let's say, where the lower limit is. Like you will not get stars with a radius lower than 10 kilometers until you do something funny in your equation of state like a phase transition.
Well, or you could, I always bring back the same example. Part of the assumption here is that there are two neutron stars.
Yeah, okay, if you had something else, if you had like a neutron star and a quark star, for example. Okay, if you had a neutron star or a black hole, then it would be even different. This is true, yes.
No, but I guess you have still a lower limit on the radius of one of the stars. I mean, one of them you don't, but the other one you do. So at least one of them would have a lower limit.
No.
The
gravitational waves don't tell you anything.
Yeah, the gravitational waves not, but you still have the optical counterpart.
Yeah, which relies on a lot of models.
Which, exactly. There is a whole lot of other issue, like how large the error in the modeling there is. Yes. But at least in principle, for the neutron star black hole, we have a very good fit formula of what the mass of the torus is, given the initial parameters of the system. So in principle, we could play a similar game. Of course, then we have to try and make this consistent with the afterglow. And at least with the numbers that are in the literature, that's not easy. But yes, in principle, if we had different numbers, we could play the same game in some form. So now the question was like, if there is something on the maximum mass, the answer is yes. And the reason for this is that in the end, we assume a black hole formation. Simply because we did have the coincident detection of a short gamma ray burst, and all models for that predict that you must have black hole formation. And if you do this, this will basically set a lifetime limit on the neutron star, and in turn, it will set a maximum mass limit that a neutron star can have. And that's also a property of your equation of state. And there have been like several works going on. I will not go in detail how this works, because that will take a bit of time to explain. But in principle, the takeaway message here is that since you did have the collapse to a black hole and you can do some mass accounting, you can say, okay, I have this mass to start with, I have some mass that I lost in mass ejection, like what is the mass that I have on collapse? And then, for example, like we use some universal relation, but you could also go with the threshold mass of this high mass case, and then you find that there will be an upper limit in the maximum mass that neutron stars can have. Say this is about 2.2. There's certain errors or systematic errors that you have to make in these models. If you want to be really conservative, you can say 2.3. But something that is higher than 2.3 is very hard to explain, because that would most likely have not collapsed for a total mass of about 2.74 that we have observed from the gravitational wave. So there will be some bound that it will be about this number. We have also checked it actually doesn't matter if you take 2.16, 2.2, or 2.3. The important thing is you have an upper bound, because that shaves off a certain, let's say, unlikely tail that otherwise you would retain in the distribution. And now, since we've been talking about this all the time, like what do we actually mean by this? The point is, now we have all these constraints that our nuclear physics has to satisfy, and we have to impose that somehow. And so we did a statistical model of saying, okay, we know from nuclear physics certain properties that the equation of state can have. Okay, I'll just show a picture here. So basically, we know since the 80s roughly what the crust of the neutron star looks like. We have very good control at the very high limit that is not really realized in the neutron stars. The regime where QCD becomes perturbative, that's at much higher densities, but we know kind of as where the pressure as a function of density has to end up at. So you have these two limits that are pretty tightly set. Then you can use recent advances in chiral effective field theory, and this will tell you a very small error band what the outer core of the neutron star is allowed to do. So this is actually constrained by nuclear physics. And then really the region inside the core where you could have your phase transitions, your hyperonic matter, whatever you think of, this is really not constrained. And this is what we parameterize using a set of polytropes. And then we selectively apply all these constraints and see, you know, what is my matter actually allowed to do in this region? And so what we did is we computed about a billion TOF stars. And then we said, okay, for all of these kind of neutron stars that are allowed, given an upper limit in the tidal deformability from the gravitational wave detection, and say a conservative two solar mass up lower limit of the maximum mass coming from this pulsar observation that we had before. What happens if now I selectively say, okay, my neutron stars cannot be too small because I have this constraint coming from the optical afterglow, and given that my neutron stars cannot be too massive because we have an upper limit on the maximum mass. And so now we selectively apply these constraints and see how our distribution function changes. So this happens if I now include an upper limit on the maximum mass. It doesn't change too much, but it kind of removes some upper part here that is now no longer allowed. And now really the main part is if I put in this additional piece, as I said, we were very, let's say, optimistic and put a very large limit of this lambda 400. And this will remove a large part here for the lower radii stars. And if we combine all of this, we end up with our final distribution, where we can actually say that, let's say, for our vanilla kind of neutron star, for 1.4 solar masses, we get a radius constraint that within 2 sigma is kind of less than 2 kilometers. So that was pretty nice, because that really constrains already a lot. And we can now quantify how much this actually constrains.
800 limit. Is it obtained by assuming two stars have the same equation state, or
yes. The problem is if you want to assume that two stars do not have the same equation of state, you have to go to some very crazy models like a quark star model. Because I mean, in principle, you assume that that kind of nuclear matter at high density always behaves the same. If you don't assume this, you have to. This is one model that says if at some point you reach a certain density in the star, the whole star would combust into a quark star. This is the only way you could circumvent that.
Right, because the first Weigel paper did not assume that, right? They have some numbers, but they have a second paper.
They have a second paper that actually strengthens this bound. I think the second paper, if you assume that they have the same equation of state, you get lambda is less than 637. That constrains a bit, but really this upper bound is not so dependent. Like the main thing is really this lower bound changes a lot. So if you're more conservative, you would now even allow a larger range there. But this is like, from all of the constraints you put in, this is the most restrictive one.
So if you went down to 200, where would your limits on R?
So I'm going to show that now because we have a plot where we show all tidal deformabilities that we got. And then this is basically what happens if you put no constraints in. And then you see it depends a bit on what the nuclear physics is. But say for 1.4, we get at the 3 sigma bound. This is like 140 or so, I think is what we got, or 150. And then you shave off a little bit of this small tail here, but you still allow a large region there. So if you are more conservative. But again, this is there's a lot of modeling uncertainty in this. And I think the latest bound is like 230 or so. That's the latest bound we have.
Are you also imposing causality on the equations of state?
Yes. Yes. All of the equations of state are causal, have at least two solar masses, and have all of these other nuclear physics constraints in. Yes. Right. So what we can do now, OK, we have already imposed that limit. Let's see. Sorry. What I want to say exactly. This actually, you can ignore this. This is the 2 sigma limit. The 3 sigma limit, as I said, is about 140 or so. Now, the interesting thing is, if you think back of your equation of state, and this is really what we started out with before imposing any constraints. I mean, this is what we know from nuclear physics. And this was all of this kind of allowed region. And just from this one detection, we can place very tight constraints, at least in kind of this diagram, because you see that most of this uncertainty suddenly disappears. The downside is that the mass radius diagram is still very degenerate, even though it looks like we now have very good control of what the equation of state is allowed to do. But at least we could exclude a lot of variability in this diagram. So this is, I think, a very nice thing. And I hope that if we have future detections, maybe also some observations by NICER, although the NICER results at least don't look so nice. The preliminary ones, at least I have seen. So, but at least there is like still room to improve, but we will need more kind of larger samples in order to make significant progress. Because we already got pretty lucky with this one neutron star merger that was just in the right mass range and provided all of the observable quantities that allowed us to make these constraints. And now, given we had this, we can see, okay, what can we learn about future detections? In principle, what can we learn about this exotic first-order phase transition if we were to observe also the post-merger event? And so in principle, you can think about it like this. I just want to first set kind of the playground so that we all know what we're talking about. I'm not a nuclear physicist, so maybe I don't know what I'm talking about, but at least I have some insights. So what we want to understand is basically this diagram. This is the phase diagram of QCD, and this tells us what matter at very extreme densities kind of has to look like, right? So you will, at some point here, have all of your neutrons and protons. This is what you have around if you squeeze it a lot, and you have like a sea of free neutrons and protons, right? And if you were to do the following, if you were to take, say, your neutron, and you squeeze even more, and at some points you will release all of the quarks that you have inside, you will become free quarks, so you have to transition from this hadronic state to your quark gluon plasma. You could do the same by also heating up your neutrons and protons, and then you would go up this way, and you would also transition to your quark gluon plasma. Okay, so you either have to increase the density or the temperature in order to change the state of matter that we have around us. Now, the crucial thing that we don't know is we don't know how we go from one state to the other. This is a bit puzzling because, say, if you think of the usual phase transition that you know, this is like your go to your kitchen, you prepare a meal, you boil water, so you go from water to gas. This is a first order phase transition. We can, you know, probe that at home. This is something we understand. But here we don't know if this transition is actually a first order transition or if it's like a second order crossover transition. And the nice thing about this is, if we want to learn about it, then the neutron star happens to lie exactly where we believe this transition to be, because it has exactly that matter inside the core, and we can ask, okay, given such a transition was first order, what would that look like? Okay, and this is what we have done.
Can we not use results from break? I mean, these collisions are creating quark gluon plasma, and they look for their thermalization, hadronization. I mean, is there nothing you can get out of that?
Okay, I jump a few slides forward, answer that question, and then I come back. So basically, the problem is, if you look at the phase diagram in terms of the observations that you have in order to access it, then these experiments probe different parts of the phase diagram. Like the relativistic heavy ion collider probes very high temperatures at low chemical potential, right? Even if you look at low energy heavy ion collisions, you don't really get down to the same region where the neutron star is. There will be this new experiment that they're building close to Frankfurt, the FAIR experiment, and they will maybe be able to kind of probe roughly this region, right? But for now, I mean, we have no experiment that can really go there. But the nice thing is if you look at the neutron star merger, then it's not just like you have the density of the neutron star, but if you smash the two things together, just like in the collider, you get very high temperatures, and so the neutron star merger conveniently probes this whole area here. So this makes it a very nice cosmic collider in that sense to study that problem.
I mean, there are other question marks about the heavy ion collisions, whether you're in thermal equilibrium at all, right?
Yes.
This phase diagram may not be the full story.
No, absolutely not. But at least with the neutron star merger, we could maybe look at part of it, if the equation of state is nice to us. I mean, if we don't have a first order but a second order phase transition, this may hide in some effects and we may never see it. So I also have to caution us here. Okay, let's go back. Now, just want to say first a few words if we can also learn something about the phase transition from the inspiral. This basically is the same work as on these radii because we have a second set of data points where we included first order phase transitions. And if you do this, what happens is you form a second branch of stable stars. Take this guy. So this is your regular star with hadronic matter. And as soon as you hit a phase transition, this is a first order transition, you can, under certain conditions, if your parameters are right, form a second stable branch. And this second stable branch would include a quark core that you would see in the inspiral. And then you can just repeat the whole analysis and ask yourself, what changes if instead of taking regular hadronic stars, I take stars that I allow to have such a first-order phase transition. And so we included many of these models in the study. And then we find the following. We find that compared to our completely nice, well-constrained diagram, we don't really have any constraining power below less than 10 kilometers. The reason for this is, there's a very, let's say, even practical reason. This lower bound in lambda that you have here comes from numerical simulations. We have no simulations, really there are none, that have any such equation of state in them, right? Because you don't have this, you don't have any statistics, you don't know what the lower bound in lambda is, and so we decided not to include this. This is simply why this region is not excluded, because we said we don't put this. There's actually one study that has done this, and then also all of this disappears for the same argument we made here, right? So this is something I have to add to that.
But do you need numerical relativity for that? I mean, you can use the positron expansion, which is what you're using anyways. And then if you have an estimate of what the deformability parameter is.
Yeah, but the deformability, the lower bound on the deformability comes from the statement how massive my torus is in the end. And then I assume that certain parts of my torus is unbound, and that gives me an optical afterglow. So this is really something that comes from the afterglow, not from the waveform. And that's really where, without a numerical simulation, we don't know. But what we can do, and this is more like an indicative statement, if you do the same plot that you make for tidal deformabilities, this plot looks exactly inverse to the hadronic plot. The reason is a quark phase transition or any softening will always make the star smaller, not larger. This introduces a natural cutoff at high tidal lambda. So this means, in principle, if you had such a system, it should have significantly smaller tidal deformability than what you get for hadronic stars. And conversely, of course, this means, should we in the future at any time make a detection where we say, okay, our gravitational wave signal says, say for high masses, we would end up here, this could not be a hybrid star. Right. So this is, for now, the only thing we can say, but at least in the future, maybe, if we detect a very massive star, we can, in principle, rule out any phase transition below a certain density.
When you include an equation with the phase transition, do you also include the latent heat release in your simulation?
No, because in this...
Why not?
Because in this case, I mean, you have no heating up. So in the inspiral, you're entirely cold. You basically assume that at some point in the future you have formed... No, this is not a collision itself. This is the inspiral. We're not there yet. In the collision, we will see something.
But do you explore the new state during the inspiral?
I mean, is the phase transition happening? That's what I'm
so in this setting, the phase transition has already happened. You assume you already have a hybrid star with a quark core that is just orbiting.
I see.
And because that we can detect.
It's in phase equilibrium.
Exactly.
Okay.
In the second part, so what comes directly afterwards, I will show a simulation where we trigger the phase transition in the post-merger, and there you see that the core is heating up.
So you're doing that now?
Yes.
Okay.
Sorry, just before you go on.
Yeah.
So you had 1.7, so I mean a reference mass of 1.7 solid.
Oh no, we just basically said because it really tightens up at very high mass, it's very difficult to get the high mass star that is very large in the phase transition, because in order to get two solar masses, the phase transition has to happen very early. This is why you have more constraining power for high mass stars than you have for low mass stars.
Right. So if LIGO happens, so we see like 1.4 merger or something that you can't really.
Then we can't say anything. Okay. Yes. So right now we cannot say anything about this. This is more like maybe we can say something in the future. Yeah. But I hope we see a high mass merger, because that via the threshold mass might also give us constraints. So that would be interesting if we see one.
So NISA would have radius measurements, right?
NISA would have radius measurements. The problem is, I mean, I'm not part of NISA, but I have seen some preliminary results that people were showing. The issue for them is they have problems obtaining the hotspot. So they cannot properly model this. And then they basically have two models. And one model says that your radius should be between 8 and 12 kilometers. The second model says it should be between like 12 and 15 kilometers. So at the moment, they didn't have so much constraining power. I think they still work on resolving that issue.
Okay, that's different from what Cole has been
telling. He's not here.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So I guess maybe they have improved on this. Like what I know is already like 4 months old or so. Like in the summer, they had some problems there. So now we get to the point where we will have the phase transition in the merger, and this will be interesting. We cannot detect this yet, but maybe we can later on. And so for this, I mean, we already have talked about this. The neutron star merger is really nice because it can, with the high temperatures, explore a large part of the phase diagram. And so what we did is we used a consistent nuclear model that is fully finite temperature and includes a phase transition at about 4 times nuclear saturation, which is densities that we reach for a high mass merger roughly about 15 milliseconds after the merger event. Now, just to also spend a few words on if we want to model this, we also need a numerical code. This is one thing that I developed. We can also do MHD. We have all of the microphysics in we need to model. We can do finite temperature. And the nice thing is because we have very high accuracy, at least if we do MHD simulations, which we don't do at the moment, we get much improved like properties of mass ejection, we get nice magnetic field evolution, and in particular, if we use finite temperature equation of state, we also get some more stability in problematic regions. Now, having this tool available, we can finally look at the study, and really what we see here is we're just right before the merger, so we have our two neutron stars, and in green I showed the density contours. So this is in units of nuclear saturation. So really before the merger, we have like 1 times nuclear saturation in the neutron star itself. On the left, I show the temperature. On the right, I show the relative fraction of quarks. So this will tell us where our phase transition is happening. And then we can run this and try to understand a bit about the physics that's going on. And so right at the merger, I pause that here. Right at the merger, what you see is you see two things. First of all, you see that your temperatures are going up wherever the stars touch. And at the same time, because the equation of state also has a crossover transition in the temperature region, you get small amounts of quarks that are triggered wherever we have hot regions. Okay? And these small amounts of quarks in the end turn out to be very important because they will also alter the gravitational wave signal. You see this covers large parts of the star, where suddenly small amounts of quarks like 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 3 begin to pop up. If we now run this for longer.
So is there any role that viscosity can play here? I mean, we're not including that in your simulation.
Viscosity. So there was this one idea that you could have neutrino bulk viscosity that could alter the waveform. The problem is when people first did these estimates, they made very, let's say, optimistic assumptions, and they got that the neutrino bulk viscosity timescale would be of the order of 10 milliseconds, and that would be very important. Now they have redone these works, and there are like 2 papers out of this exploring this both in optically neutrino trap regime and neutrino free streaming regime. And unfortunately, those timescales with the realistic calculation have gone up by almost 2 orders of magnitude.
Ah. And higher shear viscosity?
I mean, the shear viscosity must have some physical origin, right? I mean, the shear viscosity will be important later on when it comes from magnetic fields. But here, I wouldn't see what the shear would be.
If I don't have any magnetization, I mean, shear would just...
Yes, but what is the physical origin of the shear? I mean, it's not neutrino shear. Neutrino shear is irrelevant.
Just the constituents. Again, if we compare with the results in brick, okay, there's a different temperature, but you see the system trying to reach a thermal state. I mean, and that, so I'm not sure what the time scale of that might be.
I think the time scale of this is much longer. I think we don't have the time to really... You will see this if I run it for longer. I don't think we really have the time here to... get to these points. Because if we continue to run this, then first even the thermal regions will redistribute and you form like this hot ring on very short time scales. And then at some point when my density goes up, you see that you have now 2x saturation popping up at the center, 3x saturation, really the density is increasing until we go to 4x and we trigger the phase transition. It's right now. And then you see that right at the center, we get the super hot quark gluon plasma that just basically sits there. And we have a phase transition going from this way, all this way. The problem is that in this equation of state, as in many equations of state that do this, the quark phase so the quark gluon plasma is unstable and we immediately collapse to a black hole. So unfortunately, nature is not kind in this model to us. So everything will be hidden behind the apparent horizon.
Why is this? Is it more compressible or?
No, it's really like a property. The problem is if you want to be stable again, you have to form this twin branch. So you have to form stable stars with the quark core. And if you look at the allowed nuclear parameters that are consistent with experiments, it's very hard to get them. So that's really an issue. Like you can, for some models, trigger also, because you need a very strong stiffening again. And if you have the phase transition too late and you want to stiffen again, you get even like a causal because you would need like larger than the speed of light and sound speed. So it's not easy to make that work. Like our nuclear physics collaborators have tried, but so far we don't have a model for this.
Was this an equal mass merger?
That's an equal mass merger, yes.
You're also seeing the development of an M equal 1.
Yes, in this one we see the development of the M equal 1, and this seems to be enhanced for the quark phase transition. So that seems to make it worse, yes. Right, so just to summarize, I mean, we basically have these two main effects that we see. We see this crossover transition at hot temperatures. We see the formation of a quark gluon plasma, and then we do see collapse to a black hole. Now, if we want to look at this in the phase diagram, just for reference what this is doing, in principle, you can plot the same diagram here. So you have the temperature, you have the chemical potential. And so what happens is we're entering the phase transition. It's just this line in the phase diagram. Then we're releasing a lot of heat that we also believe in part coming from gravity, because I mean you have an extended system. The system is collapsing, gravitational energy is releasing, and the whole thing heats up. And then you form here the stable quark phase, or the unstable quark phase, I should rather say. And now we can ask ourselves, what does that do to the gravitational waveform? So this is what we call the low mass system. It's still pretty high mass. It's 2.8 solar masses in total. You see that in the in spiral, there are no quarks present. So that really looks the same as the hadronic model. Because one thing we can do with the equation of state, we can self-consistently exclude the phase transition, also the crossover and the first order phase transition, and we can see what the model does. So we really have like a fair comparison between having quarks and not having quarks. And we can directly see, okay, the effect of quarks, that's this red curve, is the effect of this appearance of quarks in high temperature regions is a gradual dephasing that starts to accumulate. If we now had, say, a very unequal mass merger, it might be that because the densities are lower, it might take longer for the first order phase transition here to kick in, and then you would even accumulate a larger phase difference. This will be very hard to detect and also to discern from other measurements, but at least it's interesting to see that this is really what the quarks cause in this model in the hypermassive neutron star remnant. The other thing that we see is if we look at the ring down to a black hole, so we take a slightly higher mass so that we don't have a long time to exclude to pile up that phase difference, but we look at, okay, what happens if we collapse to a black hole, and then we see that the ring down is also altered, and the reason for this is that's a difference how we perturb the black hole given that this like large object collapses or given that the hot quark gluon plasma phase collapses. So we basically have these two modifications. First, the ring down is different, and the phase difference also piles up over longer times.
Yeah, if I dare ask, there's quite a bit of vector physics that you put in, so do you believe the error, the numerical error?
The numerical error. So what we did is we also did the same simulation again using twice the resolution. That was then like 90 meters or so, just on the hypermassive neutron star itself, and we still get the same results. So the error was not that large. And I think one of the things that helped us was really having these high order methods to resolve the core, because that was really difficult because it was just a few grid points essentially that we had there at the center. But the results in that sense are robust. Yes.
You ever heard of the final black hole renders, the last and the spin, they're the same? You said?
Yeah, they're the same.
But it's just the you're exciting different modes?
Yeah.
Or do they have the
two? Exactly, that's what we think. Because we checked like the mass and the spin are the same, because it's still the same total mass that is collapsing. And also the angular momentum distribution changes slightly in the star, but not that much. Because you immediately collapse after you form the black hole. So it's really just like, I would say like a collapse with a small intermediate phase, but it's still the same.
You radiate it way a little more, right? Because the hadronic one lasts longer, right? So you are
a little longer, yes. I mean in this one, but not much.
So you think this phase shift is the most...
The phase shift is, let's say, the most interesting one because, I mean, at that point, the neutron star is still around. The problem is, of course, this is very model dependent, how your crossover is at this transition and what the equation of state is doing.
Dependent on, when you say model dependent, what...
On the nuclear model. Because, I mean, that's a fully self-consistent finite temperature model for nuclear interaction.
But that's a good thing that it's dependent.
Yes. In principle, you can. The problem is there are just two nuclear models on the market that can do that. So we don't have a lot of variability to check like what the difference effect would be. And the other model that's on the market doesn't have the phase transition in the post-merger. It has the phase transition directly at merger. And that gives you then a different effect that kind of shifts the peak frequency of the gravitational wave emission because at the merger, you suddenly end up with a much smaller remnant than you would expect. So this is a different effect. It's also a very interesting signal to say that. Right. And so in principle now, I think we can go over to the final part. And this is something new that I'm working on at Flatiron with Sasha Filipov. And this is to understand a bit if we have an additional window into what neutron stars do before they merge. And so the idea is basically to make use that the neutron stars have very strong magnetic fields. And these strong magnetic fields before the merger can start to interact. And this interaction can release a lot of energy. And this is something that we hope can be detected in one form or another. And so if you want to have like a cartoonish picture of how this works, and there are also previous studies even by people here in the room on this. So the idea is you basically have like one neutron star that has like a magnetic moment pointing up. You have another one that has a magnetic moment pointing down, roughly, let's say. And then if you look at your magnetic field lines, they will form a closed loop. And this closed loop can have some dissipation. And this dissipation will emit energy. Okay, that's like the fundamental picture we want to address here. If you want to look a bit at numbers, so the idea is this would ideally happen shortly before they merge, let's say on the last few orbits. And the thing that I want to show here is basically how we can tweak the system in order to get a fireball emission out that is very similar to what you get in the magnetar case. Right? Because if you look at the traditional kind of formula, just switch back to this one, that people have used for a long time, you get, okay, maybe if you have strong magnetic fields, say 10 to the 12 Gauss, you should get a luminosity of 10 to the 42 ERBs. The point is you can basically circumvent the limitations of this if you say, maybe I don't have a continuous emission, maybe I have a pulsed emission, and then the pulse, like in this fireball, will store additional energy that I can periodically release. Before we go there, however, I have to say like three quick facts on pulsar magnetospheres. I will not be exhaustive here, but just say a few things we have to know in order to understand the results that will come. Like if you've never seen this, how this works is you don't have these nice closed dipole field lines because you have a very extreme condition in the magnetosphere. Essentially, you have a highly conducting electron-positron pair plasma that you get because you have super strong electric fields here just at the polar region that can accelerate your particles and then cause a pair cascade. For this to fill up, you will have some field lines that will be open. This allows particles to escape. And you have some field lines that are closed up until the light cylinder, where your closed field lines would almost rotate at the speed of light. And since this cannot happen, you will have these two different regimes. Right? And an interesting thing is, if you look at the more realistic case for the pulsar, and that's not the realistic case because that's the aligned one, and the pulsar has like a misaligned magnetic moment, so it can go around and do this lighthouse effect, what we see in the pulsation, then you can more clearly see that actually these two field lines here, like the ones that go out here from the pole that, to the ones that come in, are separated by a strong current sheet, right? Because you have like these two different polarizations, and there has to be a current in between that's supporting this configuration. And the interesting thing is that this current can be unstable to plasmoid formation, and that can explain part of the pulsar emission, right? If you look at, say, like this nice PIC simulation of this, you see that you get these plasmoid islands, and when they merge, they can cause magnetosonic waves to propagate out, and this gives you radio emission for the system. And the nice thing is, keep this picture in mind, because we will see this again when we look at the binary. Now, if we want to model this numerically, I have to say a few words again about codes. Like, we need to do a little bit better than what we do in neutron star merger simulations. So recently, over the last year or so, I've worked on a code that includes the ability to dynamically put resolution in the simulation to regions of interest. This is best illustrated here. You have two black holes in like an ambient medium. The two black holes are moving. And then because we can dynamically include resolution wherever our region of interest is, say in this filament here, we can effectively, at low or moderate computational cost, just resolve this region by keeping the rest at much lower resolution. That's very important in the end if you want to effectively study this fireball on large scales, or you want to resolve these current sheets, to be able to dynamically put resolution wherever it's needed. This is typically not possible if you do any of these neutron star merger or black hole merger simulations. Just a note, like, how actually this is also useful for the neutron star, because I will be just talking about precursors at the end, but I thought, okay, maybe I show something else that I'm working on. It's basically, at the time of the merger, you have this shear layer, and this shear layer can generate, on very small scales, very efficiently magnetic fields. Now, if you have the ability to put very high resolution in this shear layer, as you can basically see here by a distribution of the grids that are just triggered on the vorticity here, you can just, at still high cost, but not super high cost, get some of the amplification resolved that otherwise you would completely miss out in the simulation. So this thing even has value beyond just the application to electromagnetic precursors.
So you're refining on vorticity?
Yes, on vorticity. So basically on vorticity in the plane, but that works pretty well even like at the upper limits, or let's say at the upper extent of the neutron star. Yes, so we basically have like the vorticity tensor omega xy that we refine on.
Is the reason you're not trying to just do like truncation error estimates or something like the standard?
We could also try to do truncation errors. My fear is that the truncation error for this system would be far too large because of the shocks, and then you start refining everything. Like, you even have to exclude like refinement, because if you see all of the turbulence here, I mean, if you would do this, you would pick up also all of the refinement in this area. So we really said, okay, we have like a density cutoff and a vorticity cutoff. This is not unlike what people in principle do also when they do like AGN disk simulations. I mean, they also don't refine on error, they refine based on density or on magnetic field properties. But I mean, this is really like, you could improve on this. Like, for the black hole merger, truncation error would be very nice, because there, I mean, it's a very clean problem, and that truncation error would be a better criterion. But this is a very, let's say, turbulent, messy problem compared to that.
So what is the maximum magnetic field that you get?
So in this thing, this is not fully converged because, I mean, still don't have enough resolution to resolve everything, but typically, depending on what you input, you get 2 to 3 orders of amplification. So you can go up to 10 to the 17 Gauss. There are other studies that have done 11 meters, and they kind of see this, but there's still no convergence, so I cannot tell you what the final field is. What I can tell you, actually, that the equipartition for the neutron star would be 10 to the 18 Gauss. But I don't think we will reach this, because otherwise maybe our neutron star would start to like fly apart or so, because the magnetic field would be far too strong. That would also modify the equation of state at some point, because then you really get into that region.
But, I mean, that's your prejudice. Like, you don't really know what you're going
to get. I don't know what I get. That's true, yes. But I have to do some assumptions on what I simulate. Yeah.
In the past, we've done kind of those simulations with very strong magnetic fields, being even within C. Pump up the magnetic fields and then chunk to the star.
Yeah.
No,
so that's what the physics
is. If it's a coherent magnetic field, but it's a tangled magnetic field, why is
You tangle it very strongly into the differential rotation.
That's right. So I'm saying if you just put a very strong coherent magnetic field, then that would cause the star to fall and fly apart. But But if you make it through turbulence, and we don't know how big you're going to get,
yeah.
then I don't see why it would just be part of it.
This was the result of the merger. So you put strong line fields in the individual stars below the equipartition
mm-hmm.
level.
Right.
And let them go through the merger, and then merger will increase it, and then we start seeing these chunks out.
Which would be like too much, you're saying it much more than.
Because it would go to the partition value. But you started with an artificially high
line
field to begin with. Well, it starts that we're coming together, we have from 10 to 15.
But I'm asking that, is this observationally inconsistent? When you say things fly apart, doesn't mean that it's inconsistent. It's because things do fly apart.
Well, observationally inconsistent with respect to what this standard line field you would think stars that were coming together would have. 10 to 15
is too much. I mean, that's already like the magnet, right? I mean, the problem is like even if you start with the lower field, it's not clear because I mean this process will be terminated as soon as the two cores merge together. Like then the shear layer is gone, so you will have a natural cutoff in how long the amplification can go on even. But we cannot simulate that at the moment, so it's very hard to give like definite answer to this.
Just for the dipole, so the tangle could be much bigger. I don't really know how much bigger that's. That's why I'm asking.
Growth rate also depends on the resolution, right?
Yes, the growth rate is also not converged with resolution, yes.
Yes, so the case is if you have higher resolution, you get a higher...
I get a stronger growth rate, yes.
Yeah.
But I mean, at some point it has to converge. I mean... Anyway, I mean, this is just to illustrate like what, given this tool, we can do kind of in nice physics. I mean, it's not relevant for the rest of the talk, and also scientifically, there is much more that needs to be done before we can get a definite answer on this. But it will be a very important answer because, I mean, this will set kind of the ratio of poloidal to toroidal field and then co-determine the evolution of the system on long timescales and all the mass ejection. So that's certainly something worth looking into in the future. But now getting back to our cartoonish picture of these two stars in the in spiral, now the trick what you can do is you can say, what if one of the stars is spinning? Okay, so you have one star that is non-spinning and one star here it's spinning. And then you connect again your field lines and the whole thing will be like a rubber band that I have between two fingers. If I start twisting the rubber band, I can tap into the rotational energy of the star. All of that energy is stored in the field lines. Okay, and at some point, if I twist too much, like my rubber band will break, and in the same sense, my magnetic field lines will break up, and they will cause this fireball type emission. And now we will basically be looking at a movie of this. And so just to tell you beforehand what we will be seeing two stars. They're pretty close in close orbit, but it doesn't really depend. We could have also put them further apart, as I will show later. And then the right star here is twisting. We see the in-plane magnetic field. We're kind of sitting on the star, and we're co-rotating while it's going around. And we will see that the color will indicate a twist, so we will see how much twist we will be building up. And at some point, we will see that these fireballs are flying out with the periodicity of the rotation of the right star. Okay, so this is what happens. You see, okay, like I'm twisting, I'm building up all of this energy, and then my flare is going to go out, and I get this nice current sheet that is plasmoid unstable, similar to what you see in the pulsar model. Now we can ask again, like, okay, what about this luminosity bound? What about our 10 to the 4, 42 ergs per second? And here on the right, I'm basically showing the ratio between this bound and what we actually get. And the nice thing is we get almost like a factor 100 enhancement to what you predict analytically. And the reason is really you tap into the rotational energy of the star, and instead of having a continuous release, you have this pulsed release. Okay, this is how you can enhance it. Yeah.
So if you are in a region where you have this twisting, right? Is it force-free or...
It's completely force-free, yes.
It's completely force-free.
Yeah. Everything is force-free and the star inside you, we have an ideal MHD condition, E is minus V cross B.
So
that is that match.
Resistivity there?
We have no explicit resistivity. This is ideal force-free. And then, again, I mean, you have this pulse-shaped thing going out and you have a second burst, and this burst actually comes from these plasmoids also flying out because they also store a lot of energy. And we can now think what kind of emission you can get. And the nice thing is if you look at this thing on larger scales, you form a very nice pancake. And this resembles a model that you have for FRB flares and magnetars. So the idea is basically that this pancake can cause some MESA emission, also has a lot of energy. This thing will actually contain most of the energy that is released, okay? And so we have one potential emission mechanism that we're looking into. It's like what we can get on this fireball on larger scales.
So you have these poles, right? So instantaneously you have very large luminosity, but if you integrate that over time,
mm-hmm.
you get the same energy as the usual magnetosphere emission as well.
Oh, you mean if on the whole this has the same emission? This has more, because you additionally have the rotational energy of the star that you tap. I mean, if you just have the two stars that go around in the unipolar inductor setup, you just tap into the energy of the orbit. But if you spin one of the stars, you also get rotational energy from the star, so this is more.
What's the ratio of the orbit period versus the spinning period?
Ah, so the light cylinder of the spin is larger than that of the orbit. So we have taken realistic values. I mean, the values that we have for the orbital spin are actually the same that you have also in your post-Newtonian kind of relation, right? I mean, because in the GR binary, I mean, if you have two stars on the orbit, the period is fixed by the separation. I mean, they're correlated.
So that means the spin period is much smaller, is much longer.
Yeah. No, the spin period is much larger, yes. So this is not millisecond spin that we have here.
What
is it, 10 milliseconds?
It's like 40, 50 milliseconds. It's not 1 millisecond. Yeah.
So how would your results depend on this spinning period? So
the problem is if the...
If spin is zero, there should be nothing here, right?
If spin is zero, there will be nothing. Actually, no. Let's wait until the end of the talk. The point is, I mean, this is the artificial toy model. I will show how we can make this realistic. And then, actually, yes, there will be a dependence on the spin ratio. But the spin ratio will more depend than on the modulation. But just wait 2 or 3 slides. The other thing you can do, I mean, this is one emission mechanism by this pancake. You can have a second emission mechanism if you look at this curvature sheet. And so what we did is we said, OK, let's look, you know, at the energy that is really flying out. So we look at Poynting's theorem that tells us, OK, locally our energy density can only be changed by an inflowing Poynting flux plus some dissipative effects going on. And what we did is we said, OK, we take the binary just to illustrate what you're going to see in a minute and a plot, is you have basically these two shells. So you have like the inflow of Poynting through these two shells. And then we also account for the energy that is stored in between. And whatever there doesn't match up has to be dissipated. Okay, so you have this energy flux. You have the locally stored energy. And now the point is, because you have this plasmoid instability, these plasmoids actually can dissipate a lot of energy that is then available to be released in radio emission. And so we quantify how much energy actually this plasmoid chain can release simply by doing this energy balance. And the nice thing is that the dissipation rate for plasmoids is independent of the resistivity for very small resistivity. So even we don't care in the simulation what our effective resistivity is. As long as it's high enough, the reconnection rate will be the same. So this is very nice about the plasmoid instability. And then what we find is the following. We look at this energy in the shell as a function of time. We see, OK, whenever this is just to indicate where the pulse is, whenever this pulse is passing through the shell, and then we have the plasmoid instability, we see a very clean dissipation happening. And this dissipation is then available to be released as energy. And we have quantified that, just to show this, also as a function of radius. And we find in this setup a very clean scaling of separation to the -7/2. Don't ask me exactly why this is. There's also a very big caveat in the simulation setup about this. And we find that the current sheet dissipation is still very large, but one order of magnitude less than what you have in the fireball, but still significant. So basically, the nice thing about this setup is, if you even ask how can we detect this, there are two distinct emission mechanisms, one being the Mesa emission from the fireball and one being this plasmoid dissipation in the current sheet that could potentially produce radio emission. And now the caveat about all of this, because what we do is we do this on a fixed circular orbit in special relativity. In principle, we have modifications that we're investigating right now with dynamical gravity at small separation, because then on the period of the orbit, you would have a significant change in the separation. So this is not yet included. But at least on larger separations, this should be pretty robust, what we find there. And now kind of as the final outlook, because there was the question like, OK, how realistic is all of this? What if instead of having a spinning star, I have a non-spinning star, but I look at the...
You think this current sheet emission is also powered by your rotation?
I mean, the current sheet emission is also powered by the rotation, because, I mean, this comes when this twisted field loop starts to reconnect. So this is all the same energy budget you're tapping into. It's just a different part that is released in a different channel. And so now the realistic case would be, because we know that pulsars have misaligned fields because we see the pulsation, so just assume one of them, they're both non-spinning or the spin is negligible, but assume one of them is misaligned. And now, because they're not spinning, you make around half an orbit, and you see already that this will cause some twists in the magnetosphere just by the motion of the orbit. So you don't need the star to do the twisting, you can do the orbit to do the twisting. And this works in exactly the same way. Like, we haven't classified the energy emission there because this is a little bit more tricky to do the budgeting. But what we see, if I show you this movie again, so we again sit on the star, the left one here is twisting. You see essentially that you get the same kind of fireball emission with the same current sheet that you saw on the toy model. So in principle, we believe that for a large number of orbital parameters, this mechanism should be robust. That's what we're investigating at the moment. And probably I just leave it here. So I'm happy to take further questions.
Thank you. So do we have any more questions?
So for these EM precursors, is this just for two neutron stars?
Mm-hmm.
Does this work for neutron star black holes?
Yes, for neutron star black hole. We're also trying to look into this. It's a little bit more complicated, but in principle, if you have a spinning black hole, it will similarly twist the field lines. So in principle, you should maybe see something different. But there, you have to resolve even the ergosphere of the black hole. So numerically, this is much more challenging to get a robust answer out.
Does the mass ratio depend at all? So if you have like...
I wouldn't say...
Black holes, if you have like a...
You have a larger mass ratio, but I wouldn't, I mean, it would affect the twisting, right? Because, I mean, the outer star is moving faster than the inner one. But I'm not sure, let's say.
I'm just thinking the results should depend on how the time scale for the twisting and the time scale between the orbiting to the collapse.
Yes. In this with the spinning case, yes. There will be at a point. Because if you're spinning so fast that your light cylinder is inside the light cylinder of the orbit, or speaking differently, if you are doing millisecond spin, right, then of course whatever the star will do will be detached from the orbit.
Sure.
Right? And vice versa. But the nice thing is, I mean, this thing doesn't have spin of the star. This is really just the orbit, I mean, this case. So here you assume like your vanilla binary with very low spin. I mean, most binaries that we know observationally have very low spin. Okay, you assume here even no spin, and the twist is entirely induced by the orbit. And the orbit is there.
I'm just thinking, so if you really twist very slowly, right?
Mm-hmm.
That will be a consequence of something like a positive equilibrium state, right? Will be no dissipation at all.
No, because I mean, in the aligned case, as long as you have no other kind of resistivity in the system for the twist to dissipate, it would just take longer. Because I mean, that system, I mean, where you just have everything perfectly aligned and it's going around, actually doesn't depend on the orbit. I've done exactly the same simulation with no orbit and you get no difference, simply because the orbit doesn't play a role. The orbit only plays a role if you have the misalignment and the orbit itself starts to build up a twist.
I'm just taking the analogy from the magnetosphere when you do the twisting, right? If you twist it very slowly, you see that will be a subsequent of like positive equilibrium state developed.
Mm-hmm.
No dissipation at all until you reach some critical twisting angle or something.
Mm-hmm.
So here, I'm just guessing, like if you really, the twisting time scale is so short.
Okay, if it's really
so long, right?
If it's really so long, it might dissipate before you get that. Yes, that is true. But I mean, the point is for the orbital time scale, this is pretty much fixed. So the nice thing is we don't run into that problem, right? Because I mean, the orbital time scale is entirely fixed by the separation. This is not a free parameter.
Yes, I agree. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, it's time.
So observationally, what are we talking about when we talk about these precursors?
I mean, we hope that we would see some radio emission from this because the luminosities are consistent with what you have in FRBs and the emission mechanism are also the same that you see there.
You mean like, but I mean, FRBs repeat at least some of them. Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, this thing repeats with the period of the orbit.
Yeah, no, but they're repeating, like the first repeater shows up 2 years later.
I mean, the point is, I'm not saying this is a perfect FRB model, right? What I'm saying is that this model can produce a similar emission with a very small repetition period, where maybe, because I mean the energy in the loop is of course strongly dependent on the separation, because I mean the dipole energy is going down if you have them further apart, where maybe you will only even see like the last one before they merge.
So this would be like a few milliseconds, a few seconds before the merger, or how that's...
I would guess like in the last second.
The last second.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's...
So it seems the emission is generated by this motion of this plasma, right? Like,
yeah.
This has to be quite relativistic, I guess. So
yes.
It's a small angle that you can see this kind of emission.
Yeah, but the point is the... if you look at the pancake, I mean, the pancake, this is at about 600 kilometers. The pancake is widening quite significantly already, right? So the nice thing is, I mean, we were worried about the same thing, that if you look on the, because the first simulation was done in a very small box, it looked like it would very beam, but then you see it's really broadening even on like 600 kilometer scales. So I'm not too worried that, you know, it's too beamed in that sense.
So, a naive question, I guess I'm going back to just a single pulsar. What sets the, I mean, how wide the cone of the emission of a pulsar is?
Ah, you mean how wide the emission, in the pulsar?
Yeah. I mean, you have like two pulsars, right?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, in this case, I think it will really depend on the misalignment of the orbit in which direction you emit this. I mean, in the realistic case, because here at the end, fast forward. I mean, here at the end, I mean, we're cutting here through a plane, but we're not even looking at the right plane. I mean, here you see there is a clear predominant emission going more in this direction than in this direction, simply by the orbital alignment of the two magnetic moments. So I would guess there will be a dependence on, you know, how misaligned they are, on how wide this is. But we haven't classified this yet. I mean, we just studied mainly the aligned one, and now we have some early results also on this one.
There are no more questions. Let's thank them once again.